From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made last Tuesday at the polls, where Monroe County saw historic voter turnout for the 25th Congressional District Democratic primary. 19% of registered Democrats voted in that primary. In previous years, that number was 5 and 8%. This year's primary turnout was the highest since 1992. But 19% is still fewer than 1 in 5 registered voters, so should we be celebrating? Even in the 14th district, where millennial Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez beat longtime Representative Joe Crowley in a stunning upset, only 13% of registered Democrats went to the polls. So in this current moment, when people are claiming to be more engaged in politics and social causes, how do we transfer that enthusiasm to action? What can we change in terms of voting laws to increase access? My guests will weigh in on that this hour, and we want to hear from you as well. Joining me in studio is Tom Ferrazzi, Monroe County Board of Elections Commissioner, coming off of a very busy time. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
And Michelle Long is an election inspector in Monroe County. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Megan.
Jesse Lenny is the Western Region Political Director for New York Working Families. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Megan.
And joining us later is Simeon Bannister. He's the Interim Vice President of Community Programs at the Community Foundation. And listeners, as I mentioned, as we talk about possible changes when it comes to voter access, we do want to hear from you this hour. You can call the program at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI. 263-9994. You can also email the program at connections@wxxi.org, and you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. So I'd like to start the hour with a pretty broad question for all of our guests. Critics of election law say that New York could do a lot more to allow people to vote, but others say that low primary turnout is more about lack of civics education. So some differences in opinions there, but let's start with Tuesday. What do you think is the most significant factor driving turnout in which fewer than 1 in 5 registered voters decided to participate? Tom, we'll start with you.
Okay. One of the things, and just to clarify, one of the things in terms, we talk about historic turnout and excitement about it. I don't want to say the excitement is about the 1 in 5, but the excitement about it is that we seem to have turned a corner. Primaries are coming back up again. We saw that last year in the primary last year. It actually about a 5% jump in what was the average, and it had been falling off up until then. So we're really, really feeling good about that. But I think changes could be made. And I think what's evident from there is evident from every election, and that is people's lives have changed. Their ability to get to polling place is different. It isn't like you're coming off from a shift to Kodak or Xerox and can get there easily. I think a lot of the things, and maybe we'll discuss them today, that can change is and jumps right out is early voting and a no-fault absentee. I think looking differently how we register people, and we can do that. Electronic poll books would allow us to register people later, that kind of stuff. So I think there's a lot of things we can do to improve the voting process. And I think hopefully this kind of discussion will begin to open those doors.
In your view, what is the biggest change that we can make? If you named a lot of things, I'd like to talk about them, all of them this hour. But if you had to choose one thing that you would change in New York State, what would that be?
I think we should join the rest of the country in early voting. And I think that would have a fairly big impact. I think that impacts mostly, like I said, the people whose lives, you know, they're not centered around one day. Working schedules and what have you, long shifts, that kind of stuff. Very different than it was many, many years ago. So probably that opens up the door for more people.
Okay. Michelle Long, what is the biggest change that you would like to see happen, or the biggest reason behind low turnout in New York State?
I think it's a hard question for me because as an elections inspector, I sit at the polling site all day and I see everybody who does come in. So I see people who are engaged and excited. But I have had conversations, just casual conversations with other people. I know people who aren't registered to vote at all, or people who don't know when the primary and general elections are, and I think they're just, I've heard people say that they're not excited about what's happening, or they don't think their voice is big enough and that their vote doesn't matter. So I think some of it's just attitude.
Does that go into education for you? Do you think we should be doing more for students, talking to kids in high school or even college about here's some civics education. I remember when I was in high school, I did not take this class, but it was called Participation in Government. I wasn't required to take it, so unfortunately I didn't, because I was in a different class. But I remember that some of my fellow classmates had one lesson on voting, just one. And I don't know how well it stuck with them, but what do you think, Michelle? Should we be doing more? And if the answer is yes, what does that look like to you?
Yeah, I had the same experience as you did. There was a participation in government class at my high school, and I took AP Gov instead. And I do feel like maybe I missed something by not taking that class. But I do think the education piece of saying, this is how democracy works, this is why it works, this is why it's important, and this is what each of us can do to make it happen in a way that is, you know, robust and meaningful.
Jesse, I'll turn to you now. In all of the work that you do to try to get people to the polls, what's the most significant reason you think people are not turning out?
Well, I would say there's a host of policy changes we can make, including early voting, like Tom mentioned, but same day registration, voting by mail. But I think we need to look at the whole voting process. I think the turnout on Tuesday, last Tuesday, was high because there was several dynamic candidates in the race. And you know, Joe Morelli, who we supported, because the race was competitive, he ran a very strong race. And that forced the candidates to get in front of the voters. The voters felt like they got to know the candidates, and they felt confident to come out and vote. And I think the easier if we can make it easier for people to run, then we'll have more candidates. And if we have more candidates, there'll be more competitive races, and voters will vote more. And I think that's the fundamental reason we support a small donor matching program in New York State. Is if small donors, not just big donors and not just corporations and PACs, were involved in funding these campaigns, more people could run. And more information would get out there, and voters would feel like they knew the candidates better, and they would participate more.
I'll turn back to Michelle and Tom. What do you think about that idea? I don't know how much you can say about that, Tom, but how do you feel about donor-funded? Go ahead and explain that.
Small donor matching. I mean, we call it public financing, but it's really a way to encourage small donors. Right now, less than 0.5% of us participate in by financing these elections. So someone's paying for them, and it's not us. And a small donor matching program encourages people to contribute small amounts of money that are then matched only if the candidate qualifies. You know, 6-to-1 in New York City, for example, but it could be 3-to-1. It could be whatever makes it work. And so that way, candidates don't have to be connected to big corporations and PACs in order to run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I would like to see public financing campaigns. I think, to be honest with you, that would change the whole dynamic. Unfortunately, it depends on how you set that up, because we've seen some models out there already where, unfortunately, the candidate decides that it's better to go ahead and take other monies rather than to go into the public financing part of it. So it really depends on how it's set up. It might require a little bit more extensively in terms of limiting what people can and can't do relative to campaigns, so that in fact the playing field is level. I mean, and that's really what you're trying to get at. That's really what I think Jesse's trying to raise, is the issue of leveling the playing field so that all the candidates kind of have the same opportunities to get their message out.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, I see you nodding.
Yeah, I think, you know, we talk about money being speech, which seems ridiculous. So I really like the idea of public financing. I think that can go into that idea of, you know, people's individual voices being heard and feeling that their vote matters if they know that the candidates are not being bought by corporations and other organizations with agendas that maybe don't line up with ours.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, if you'd like to join this conversation, it's 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I'm seeing your comments come in via email, so we'll get to those shortly. But I do want to break down some of these ideas that we've already talked about in terms of what can change. And we'll start with early voting. And there's some research out there on early voting, and it's conflicted. So according to NPR, studies on this have turned out to have scattershot results. On the one hand, a 2008 paper assessed the research and found that early and absentee voting together have a small but statistically significant impact on turnout, somewhere between 2 and 4%. But then there's evidence in the opposite direction. A recent study found that early voting may indeed slightly reduce turnout because it found that for every 10 days a state offers early voting, turnout declines by 1 percentage point. The researchers concluded that early voting may bring in some new voters, but that's counterbalanced by the fact that early voting takes away attention from Election Day itself and get-out-the-vote efforts. So, Jesse, I'll turn to you first. I know conflicted research, we don't have anything that we can really hang our hat on right now, but would you like to see early voting in New York State, knowing that there's a slight chance it could reduce voter turnout due to those issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think early voting would be great. I mean, I think we should be voting over the weekend. I mean, obviously, Tom and his staff does a great job, and they would need the resources to make sure that they could do that. And, you know, I think on the flip side, too, we also need the voters to do that. I mean, we need, you know, we could, it's easy to say we should expand it from 9 hours to 3 days worth of voting, but I think we need the candidates first, then the voters, and then there'll be pressure to increase that. I think GOTV would just be 6 days long instead of 3 days long if we had 3 days of voting. I also think, Tom mentioned no-fall absentee voting, or if it's mail-in voting. I mean, if we can do that, that would make it a lot easier. And then GOTV operations could, in some states, GOTV lasts for a month. You know, I mean, I think it just depends on, if you have the candidates, then having more access to the ballot would increase, you know, that much more.
Is this too idealistic, Tom? Do you think it's too difficult for New York State to have early voting? Why haven't we gotten there yet?
I don't know why we haven't gotten there yet, and I don't think it is too difficult, particularly with the technology we have today. There's a lot of things we could do. It's going to cost a little bit of money, as Jesse mentioned, the resources. But I have to be honest, it really is very doable. The one thing about it is that, and when you look at these studies, you got to be really careful, because some of these studies, they're dealing with some states that have as much as 45 days, some 30. I guess my belief is 8 days is good, because it gives us 2 weekends. That's kind of my preference. I think the number of locations you have, how those locations function. Sometimes they have them regional in some states. Some have them only for certain elections. There's all sorts of things. I would like us to be in a position where you could walk into any one of the sites in the county. I think that's a much more friendly process for people who are at work. They can go there. There's just a lot of different things, and with the variations of early voting across the country, I think, like I said, the kind of studies that have been done can be really skewed. Also, too, in reality, early voting, although it's been in existence since probably early 2000s, I think that it is still relatively new in terms of how it's functioning. And so a lot of these studies have not determined what the long-term effect is. I think as we see it grow, the voters will come along with it and possibly use it. And coupling that with, again, what we call a no-fault absentee or just a ballot, as you can request a ballot, I think it definitely will have an impact. And I think it'll have a much bigger impact than we're seeing in studies because of those reasons that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, you and I have had conversations offline about the cost of some of the requests that people are making. The thing we talked about specifically was on primary day, the polls opened at noon. And there were many people who took to social media or even called our newsroom and said, why can't the polls be open at 9? I want to go vote before I go to work. And you mentioned everything costs money. So do you agree with Tom in that, you know, it's difficult, it's doable, but there are certain things we have to consider when it comes to the finances?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the idea of having more time to vote and encouraging people to vote at times that are convenient for them are great. I don't know what the Board of Elections budget looks like, but everything.
Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah. but everything costs money. And, you know, my experience and expertise is just being a poll worker, and I know how much they have to pay me. And I know how many people work in my polling site, and I don't know how many polling sites are in the county, but it's a lot, like 800 or something.
Yeah, well, not quite, but there is that. She's right about that, and that the problem that you've got is we're trying to catch up. We're going over a 3-year process where we're increasing the poll workers' pay, but it's still just barely minimum wage, and it's terrible, but. The problem you have is that with every, because there's so many, and we have, on a regular election day, we have over 3,200 poll workers one day out there in about 400 locations. So it's kind of a business how you might do that is really definitely there. But I still think that there's ways to work that through. And for example, if we were to do early voting, what we might do is instead of talking about expanding the hours, we might talk about reducing the hours on election day. If we're open for 8 days prior to the election, do we need to be open from 6 in the morning till 9 at night? Or would 7 to 8 to 7 do? I mean, those are the kind of things that you definitely need to look at. And can one thing affect the other? And can we find balance? And I think that that's really where we're the discussion should be talking about instead of, oh my gosh, it's going to cost a fortune. It is. But can we save money elsewise? And can we make this work as our balance?
That's a great point. Related to that and to something you brought up earlier, why is it that we can't just vote in any polling place? I understand why we're listed in certain neighborhoods and everything, but why can't that change? That seems like a simple fix to me, but maybe I'm being ignorant.
Well, the problem you got is that we need a ballot for you to vote on. And currently, we don't have a ballot on demand system in this county. That would cost a lot of money. And frankly, it's money that we're ultimately going to spend. But maybe through the early voting process is how we begin to do that, beginning to look at new equipment that would do ballot on demand. But right now, I have to have a ballot for you when you walk in your polling place. And given redistricting, I can tell you it's pretty interesting how those lines are cut. So the next district over may be different assembly members, different senators. All of that is different. So I actually have a ballot sitting there waiting for you when you come into the polling place. If, in fact, I was to let you go any place, those, you know, 500,000 ballots that I produce, I'd have to produce multiple times and have them in multiple places.
But what if we move to online voting or a digital system?
Well, you've taken kind of a step over that nobody else is willing to even talk about. Nobody in the country.
Well, we have about 40 minutes left.
I think that's going to happen eventually. I think you have a new generation coming along, and they deal with this stuff a lot better than my generation does, or even the generation just behind me. But I think that that's not going to happen right away. I think there's some other steps that we can take, in the meantime to open up this door a little bit more in terms of getting people to vote. And that's a discussion we should have, but it's a discussion that I think is going to, because of the concerns, particularly nowadays with cybersecurity and everything else, we spend multiple times each week on that issue. So that's not going to happen in the foreseeable future. It's coming, and I'm convinced it's coming. You're going to be able to vote on your phone eventually, so, or whatever your phone looks like in the future. Who knows?
We're talking about increasing access to voting, and listeners, you are welcome to join this conversation, 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. The phones are already starting to flood, and Simeon Bannister is also here joining us. He's the Interim Vice President of Community Programs at the Community Foundation. Thanks for being here. And Simeon, what is the most significant reason behind people not turning up to the polls, in your opinion, in your experience?
Sure. Well, I think it's obviously a very complicated issue that has some complicated solutions. But I think at least one part that is absolutely critical centers around education. I think that there's something to be said for the decline of participation in government, civics classes, broadly speaking, and the extent to which folks have kind of lost track of how central voting and participation in government is to the soul of our society. And as we see some of the major changes that are happening, both here in our local community, but obviously on the national level, it seems to me that whether the expenditures are significant or not, it's really time for us to ensure that every voice and every vote is counted in any way that we can possibly do that. Absolutely critical, because if we don't, then we have something that is at best a perversion of our democracy.
What specifically does that kind of curriculum look like to you?
Sure.
Because we can talk about improving access to civics education, which we spoke about a little earlier with Michelle, but what would you like to see in a lesson plan? What do students need to know as they're turning 18?
Well, I think it's the evaluative skills, right? How to actually, identify candidates, how to look through the platforms, how to understand exactly what's being articulated. I think folks have a working knowledge of of how municipal and governmental budgeting works, just so that there's at least a working knowledge to kind of see through some of the, you know, facade, frankly, that often characterizes elections. I think also just a general awareness of how government works, right? Who is responsible for what? Who has decision-making power over what? It's often been said, it's certainly become a cliche now, that all politics is local, Tip O'Neill. But the fact is that if folks have an appreciation for who's responsible for what, then that increases greater accountability. And I think that's one of the pieces I think that we can all appreciate is missing is more accountability in our system for elected officials, because folks have, you know, just kind of checked out. It's one of the interesting dynamics of a representative democracy, right? The whole premise is that we can't all be there looking deep at the budget and all that kind of stuff, but we want folks that at least have the skills and understand and appreciate those dynamics to be able to kind of bring their attention to the, you know, to these issues, so that when it's time to vote, that we're making informed votes, because democracy really does depend on informed constituencies.
Listeners, I'll call on you. If you're a teacher and you're teaching participation in government, I want to hear what kind of questions your students are asking, what your lesson plans look like, if they're similar to what Simeon's saying. So if you're listening and you fall into that category, please call the program. We'll make sure we get a chance to talk to you. But I'm seeing a lot of questions come in about registration. So let's go to the phones. We'll also turn to email and see what our guests think about these questions. Up first is Pat in Fairport. Go ahead, Pat.
Hi. I'm wondering why we continually talk about the current opt-in system for registration for voting, and instead why we don't look more seriously at an opt-out program. It would be something as simple as a citizen turns 18 years old, they're automatically registered by their state to vote. They get a letter from their local board of elections acknowledging where they vote, what districts they're in for different levels of government, when election day is, et cetera. And then in that can be a form that allows them to opt out if they choose to, if they don't want to participate in their government and the election of their representatives. And also that could work for those when they become citizens. When they become a citizen, they're automatically registered. And that way we're really taking seriously the idea of voting as our right, a constitutional right, and not something that we do other than that. And I'm just curious about why we're not a little more serious about opting out rather than opting in.
Okay, thanks, Pat. I'll let our guests respond. I saw everyone around the table nodding.
I think it's a great question. I mean, and universal registration is something that I've talked about numerous times in various presentations around the county. There's a lot of ways that we can move in that direction if, in fact, people aren't comfortable jumping right to that. But I think that certainly is something that we should be looking at and moving towards that. Interim steps, statewide registration instead of county registration, just the whole kind of different ways of doing registration. But I think universal registration should be an ultimate goal, yes.
Michelle?
I had a question about whether or not that is a thing in any, are there any states that do it? Do we have any research about whether or not that increases voter turnout?
I don't have anything in front of me right now, but I can find out. Unless Tom or Simeon, you have.
Well, there's some not specifically related to voting, but there's some really interesting research that's been done. Behavioral economics. I know in Sweden there was a change for organ donors, and so you would opt out of organ donations, and organ donations went up like dramatically. I mean, like to the tune of like 80% opt-in. Or 80% participation, rather, because of having folks automatically opted in as opposed to opting out. There's a lot of great research. The, I'm going to mess up and say, is it Richard Thaler, I think it was, but don't quote me on that, is one of our recent Nobel Prize winners who's done some fascinating research on behavioral economics as it relates to opt-in programs. The one thing I will say is, I think it's fair to ask the question, qui bono, right? I think, you know, there's generally universal agreement that everybody should have the opportunity to vote, right? There's generally universal agreement that we want everybody's vote to be counted. I think it's very difficult to find folks that would disagree with that. So then why isn't it happening, right? Who stands to benefit? Who stands to gain when people aren't participating in our process? Who stands to benefit when certain voices seem to be marginalized? Right? Who stands to benefit when folks that have been released from prison who should have their voting rights restored and those rights aren't restored? Who stands to benefit? Who stands to benefit when communities of color in particular are left on the sidelines from being able to participate in our elections? And I think those are the real questions that we've got to start asking if we're going to really get to the bottom of this problem, because in many ways, the legislative process has lent itself to allowing those folks to kind of hide out in some corners and to be obstructionists and block the kinds of reforms that are necessary both in this state, but then also just nationally. And I think that's a really, you know, kind of critical piece of this that we've got to start to explore.
Do you think voting should be compulsory?
I don't know that it should be compulsory. I mean, folks, you know, deserve the right to choose. And in many ways, people make a statement in some instances by not voting. I often hear after elections, you know, folks kind of lament that, you know, how unfortunate it is that people didn't, you know, come out in their interest and vote for the candidates that they should vote for. And I think that sometimes people have made a choice not to participate, right? And so, and people shouldn't be deprived of that opportunity. So I don't know that compulsory is the right route. But I absolutely think that, like I said, folks being informed, folks having education, I think those are the kinds of things that then lead to better candidates, and better candidates drive people to come out and participate.
Mm-hmm. Jesse, what do you think?
I mean, we definitely support universal or automatic registration, also same-day registration. People walk up to their polling place on election day, they can register on the spot in some places. And but you know, I think that would help, that would be better. But I think when, you know, and just in being involved in campaigns, with limited resources, it seems like there's always limited resources. It's hard to imagine candidates spending money on folks who were automatically registered. I mean, we already have it at the DMV where you can register at the DMV. We should expand that to other agencies so that makes it easier. But you know, what we really need is more resources, more candidates. Like Simeon said, you know, but obviously knowing where folks live or where they once lived is a help for candidates can reach out to different constituencies to expand the people that they want to talk to for an election. But given limited resources, I think it's we shouldn't expect a whole lot of turnout based on those improvements.
Mm-hmm. So 12 states and the District of Columbia do have automatic voter registration. I'll see if I can find some research on the effectiveness of that as we continue throughout the hour. But we'll take more of your questions next. Up next is Tony in Pittsford. Go ahead, Tony.
Hello. Great discussion. I think voting and participation is key to democracy in America today. First off, I'm going to ask about instant runoff voting, but I wanted to comment first that electronic voting should be technologically legally doable, because, I mean, we're already trading billions and billions of dollars worth of value at Wall Street on a daily basis. I cannot think that security cannot be equivalent to doing a vote once a year or twice a year, whatever it might be. So I think that we can do this. I think it's just the political will to take the risk to do it. We've got to start thinking about those things or we will be way behind the technology curve. But I was interested in asking about instant runoff voting, because as we noticed, Joe Morelli only got 45% of the vote, so he won a plurality, whereas the other candidates all had, 17, 18, 19% of the vote. And instant runoff voting would seem to me to be a better approach when you have more than one candidate. In fact, I think it's better for all elections to allow us to say our first, second, and third choice, because otherwise it can dilute votes and result in a minority winning candidate like we might have recognized here a few years back. So talk to us about why we aren't using instant runoff voting more in New York State to deal with these, so that more candidates can participate and have a sense of participation and not just they're going to vote for the guy who's going to win because they know that a vote for me is a wasted vote. When with instant runoff voting, it wouldn't be a wasted vote.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks, Tony. Great questions. Turn to our guests. Tom, you look like you're ready.
Well, not ready. I think Maine right now is the one state that is doing something like that.
Yes.
And they just had their first election relative to that. They're working through a number of glitches in terms of that process. I think a lot of people are kind of sitting back and waiting to see how that unfolds. It definitely does complicate the voting process somewhat, but you know what? Good results should not be pushed aside just because something's hard to do. I think it's just we're just trying to wait and see what happens. And again, it's a situation where people say this absolutely is. And I have to be honest with you, when somebody says absolutely, I kind of go, because I always question everything. And that's just the way I've been. It's interesting because the people from Maine have kind of went, well, we're not sure exactly yet how it worked, if it worked well or not. And I'm kind of curious. I'm kind of curious to see, give them some time to fix that and what have you. The other thing is I do have to go back and I don't want to take a lot of time, but we use the financial markets to suggest somehow that, well, if you can do that with financial, then in fact voting should be very secure. The problem with that is that when financial markets, you walk away with a receipt. You get emailed a receipt, you get texted a receipt, whatever it is, you get some kind of document that, and then once a month you reconcile whatever it is that you did. You reconcile your account, your holdings, whatever it is. And so in essence, there's a control factor there. The problem with electronics and elections, and we haven't figured out how to get around this yet, is that once you cast that vote, you have no way of coming back and saying, can I have the 15,000 people that voted for this candidate raise your hand? That doesn't work. And as a voter, you don't have the opportunity to come back and say, well, my vote didn't get cast the way I suspected it did. I can tell you didn't get my deposit, and I have a receipt that says you got to put it in there. But, it's funny because I bought into that argument for a long time until when we began to look at the analysis on it, we realized it just isn't the same thing. That doesn't mean I don't support electronic voting. I really want to see us move in that direction. I think it's going there. As I said to you at the beginning, I think we're going to vote on phones or whatever that is in the future. But right now, we still have a number of issues that would have to be resolved there.
And I would guess that the financial sector makes a lot more mistakes than Tom and the staff at the Board of Elections does, because the Board of Elections can't afford to make mistakes. We're another five-way race a few miles from here, Canandaigua, and it stretches all the way to Ithaca and Dunkirk. The election for Congress is within... our candidate, Tracy Matrano, is a fantastic candidate. Was down 26 votes a few days ago, and I think she's up a couple dozen votes now against her opponent, who's also a great candidate. But these elections, so many. I mean, maybe it's because I'm a practitioner. I come across this. Everybody says your vote counts, but it's amazing how every single year how many elections are down to dozens, and so the Board of Elections has to be correct within one vote. Whereas the financial sector can be off, by a lot, and they can fix it later on, and it's not like the fate of the control of the House of Representatives hinges on whether or not the Xerox stock price was right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The one thing I will say, though, is just some of the advances in technology are really interesting, and so I think a lot of, about the crypto space and some of the things that are happening there in terms of, capacity for independent verification and and kind of these distributed networks that, seem to show some promise for kind of keeping some of the funny business out of the process. And so I think Tom's right that it'll be interesting to see over time how this emerges. But again, I just, want to stick a pin in making sure that we keep track of the folks that say, hey, this is not in my interest, right? And then, do some things that might obstruct, these very promising technologies.
Mm-hmm. We will be having a conversation about ranked choice voting, maybe as early as next week on this program. So listeners, if that's something you're interested in, we'll be sure to post that as soon as that program is booked. So we'll continue with our phone calls because there are so many of you waiting. I'll just ask you to keep it tight if you can, because we want to hear from as many of you as possible. Up next on the phones is John in Henrietta. Go ahead, John.
A few years ago on public television, I saw a special about voting in Australia, and there it's required. You pay a fine if you don't vote, but they have they give you several days, and I don't know what all is involved. I don't remember the details. But I actually think if you don't vote, you're not a citizen. So if people don't want to vote, maybe there should be a subclass of residents instead of citizens. I think a citizen is somebody who's involved. That's my comment. I'll take any comments off the air. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, John. I'll turn to Simeon for that because you brought up this point earlier, and you mentioned some people do not vote by choice because they're protesting something. They're trying to make a statement by not voting. So how would you respond to John's call?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's legitimacy to that, you know, to the argument that people do sometimes take an affirmative action by not taking an action. And I think the deprivation of that choice in some ways would be anti-American. I always get nervous when I hear anything about subclasses or anything like that. And so I probably would be, you know, go a different way than the caller suggests and John suggests. That being said, John, I mean, I absolutely agree that people need to be participating, that the essence of our democracy is participation. But it's also incumbent upon, you know, the institutions that our society has to make it, A, as easy as possible, and then B, it's incumbent on those institutions to provide, you know, strong candidates. And institutions in this case, I'm primarily talking about the political parties, you know, really have an obligation to field and identify the best folks. And it's also, frankly, incumbent upon all of us, those folks that are out there. If you think that, you know, you've got something to offer and you think that you can bring something to the table, then, you know, raise your hand and stand up. I was on my right, and I was listening to Jesse's commentary in terms of public financing, which I think is absolutely critical. I mean, I just, you know, the fact is that, you know, the thumb on the lever is often far too great, you know, for certain folks. And I think that that's deeply problematic for a society that, again, you know, what's happened is that there's a contradiction between the premise of our democracy and how it actually operates. And so the premise is that, you know, one person, one vote, everybody gets a chance to speak up. Everybody has an equal, you know, opportunity to both cast that vote and to run for office and put themselves forward. But in terms of its actual practice, that's not the case. And we need to resolve that contradiction because if we don't, then we're going to continue to get, you know, in many ways what we have right now. And without calling any names, I find myself very concerned about what we have right now.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, I feel like the informed voter is really the only check against big money and in politics. I think that's why I don't think we should force people to vote. But a lot of most of the people I've talked to who don't vote just don't feel like they know the candidates well enough or know what the job of the person of the position they're running for. And so forcing that person to vote may actually empower big money who can afford TV commercials. And I mean, an informed voter can't be swayed by a 30-second TV commercial. And the real toxic nature of big money and campaigns, from what I see, is elected officials who fear the impact of a nasty TV ad or a nasty mail or from a dark money pack that they have no idea where it's coming from or when it's going to hit, and they don't have the resources to respond. And if an informed voter is not going to be swayed by, you know, a dark image on a mailer or a nasty TV ad. So I think the only way we can overcome that is to give candidates the resources to run good campaigns and educate voters so that they're not influenced by that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, just to add to that, I think it really is important, though, that we talk about how this kind of thing is implemented, because I think it's really important if you're going to get everybody to buy in, there has to be a system in place that kind of takes that money out of the everybody's race. Because as long as it's there, I don't think we've seen a couple of races that have been able to draw small money and enough amount to deal with running a positive campaign, and I think it is doable. But I think, unfortunately, at this given juncture, not all races would work that way. Not all races would play out that way until we can get some of that big money out of the mix and some of that money out of the dark corners of recesses of independent PACs and stuff like that, because they're not really independent. I'm sorry, I just don't think they are.
Mm-hmm. For listeners who have questions about what's going on in Australia when it comes to compulsory voting, federal compulsory voting began in 1924, and the penalty if you don't have a valid and sufficient reason to not vote, the penalty is $20. So I hope that answers some questions for some of you who were weighing in on that. Up next on the phones is Tom in Brighton. Go ahead, Tom.
Good afternoon. Just a technical point I'd like to make. Most people are enfranchised to vote not by the United States Constitution, but by their state constitutions. The U.S. Constitution has no provision to enfranchise voters to vote. It does have some provisions which have been interpreted by the Supreme Court which prevent discrimination based on, you know, criteria like religion and race and things like that to prevent people from voting. But as you know, early in the country's history, only white males who owned property had the franchise to vote. And then gradually it was extended to other people and then eventually to women and people of other races. But the U.S. Constitution, as of today, does not guarantee citizens the right to vote.
Okay. Thanks very much. I'll turn that over to our panel. Anyone want to weigh in on that issue? Looks like everyone's...
It is a state's issue. I mean, and we found that with Help America Vote Act. We found that even with the MOVE Act, the federal government has a limited amount of authority in terms of what it can do to affect local races. But they have found more ways to get themselves into those races. And I'll be frank with you, I can't show this because it's a radio thing, but in 2000, the regulations from the federal government were about that thick, and today they're about that thick. And I've done that. I've shown that at various.
They look like they've tripled.
Yeah, it's a lot thicker.
quadrupled. Yes. And so I mean, in a lot of ways, the regulations that have come about have definitely moved themselves. That's why we have two primaries this year, is because of those federal regulations and a federal judge's ruling.
Mm-hmm. We have a number of questions coming in about mail-in voting. I'll try to summarize them for our guests. Only three states can vote by mail right now. We'll just go around the table. Are any of you, or would you like to see mail-in voting in New York State, Tom?
I think mail-in voting would be a definite option that we should be looking at and considering. And the three states you're talking about do all mail-in voting versus other states that have, as we've talked about earlier, the kind of the no-fault absentee where you can get an absentee ballot or a mail-in ballot if you want to. There's a lot of states that do that.
Mm-hmm. And those are Colorado, Oregon, and Washington.
Those are all mail, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, mail-in voting.
I think it sounds like a good idea, but again, I always have that question of how's it working there and is it actually increasing voter turnout?
Well, to your point, some of those concerns are about ballots getting lost in the mail, whether or not it makes it easier for people to coerce family members into voting for a certain person because they're sitting right there helping them fill out a form. So does that, where do you fall with those types of issues, Michelle? What's the risk reward to you?
Yeah, there's the accountability of knowing it's anonymous and that it's actually being counted, I think are really important issues. And I don't know how you get around those. You know, the idea that you show up at a place in your neighborhood. Or if we go to on-demand ballots and maybe people can show up in the lobbies of their work, but it's still a space that you go that's private and separate from everything where you can actually have a vote that counts and is your conscience. I think this is really important.
Mm-hmm. Jesse?
I often vote absentee because I travel for work, so I don't really know where I'm going to be on election day. I mean, I felt like for years that it was more convenient than voting in my neighborhood because I don't know when I'm going to get home at night either. So, I mean, I go into the Board of Elections at some point when it's convenient for me. I apply for the ballot. It comes in the mail. I mail it back, and it's done. I mean, it's easier for me, and I'm not sure how much more expensive it is for the state.
Well, you know, the other piece of this is that people worry about did we get the ballot back or something. Today, and we're one of the few counties in the state that have online, you can go online in our voter app and you can look and see if you have an absentee application in. You can look and see if your ballot's been mailed to you. You can look and see if we've gotten your ballot back. That's all online today, and it has been for years because it's something we really thought was important. So some of those issues can be, you know, mitigated and protected by various systems that you can put in place, one of the ones that we've done in this county.
Mm-hmm. Simeon, mail-in voting.
Yeah, I think, you know, to both Jesse and Tom's point, I mean, I think the mechanism's already there in place for us to be able to do it with, I would think, relative ease here. We already have an absentee ballot program, as just alluded to. And so essentially what we'd be talking about is extending the absentee ballot program, I mean, you know, as a practical matter. And so that's not, you know, a Herculean mountain to climb. I personally think that, you know, for absentee ballots, as I recall, and Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, that you have to give a justification for why you are asking for the absentee ballot. I think we ought to just abolish that altogether and just let people, if you want an absentee ballot, take an absentee ballot. And just, you know, and then functionally we'd have a mail-in program.
Yep, agreed.
Mm-hmm. A couple questions about voting holidays. So speaking of the general election, of course, on a Tuesday in early November. That was instituted in 1845 to make it easier for farmers to be able to go vote. Our society has changed a lot since 1845. And so some people are saying, should we change the day of the general election? And then related to that, should there be an election holiday where no one is working, everyone has the entire day to go vote? Thoughts on that? Election holidays and changing the general election day.
We always would like to see Election Day as a holiday. I guess we've been pushing for that for years. But it's funny because you bring up something that kind of in, I guess at this moment, is really relevant, and that is that former Congresswoman Slaughter had a bill to vote on the weekend, to change Election Day to weekend voting. She really believed that this Tuesday thing was kind of an old-style thinking, and her thought was that we need to kind of change that and open that door and allow voting over a whole weekend. And so, I think there's definitely is something to making Election Day some type of holiday. Although if you're going to do early voting, hopefully that begins to fix that. But, you know, there are people that go on a 2-week shift that they would not work for them. And so that's why the no fault absentee, that it's the combination of things that would probably make me step back and say, okay, well, it doesn't have to be a holiday as long as we've got all these other options in place.
Well, I wish I had the stats in front of me, but Americans get so little time off compared to European countries and developed countries that have guaranteed vacation time. Americans don't get anywhere near as much vacation. They don't take it. They don't take holidays. They work 7 days a week. I mean, people in healthcare work on Christmas. You know, I think what we need is, like what Tom mentioned earlier, 8 days of voting in person, mail-in, the combination. I think a holiday is wishful thinking since we've got to the point where American workers don't get any time off. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And look, I mean, a slate of election reforms was proposed in this year's legislative session. They did not get traction, and so we have not seen any of those changes on the state level. Ostensibly, Congresswoman Slaughter's bill did not get traction in Congress, and so therefore was not passed. Mm-hmm. Why? Right? I mean, we know that more voting is better for our democracy. We know that more informed voting is better for our democracy. We all agree on that. I mean, that is almost universally agreed upon, regardless of background, political party, and so on and so forth. We believe that people should be voting and participating. And so what is the obstruction? And I think that's what we have to ask ourselves. What is the obstruction? Who is not voting for these reforms? Who is standing in the way of progress? And then when we have the opportunity, and this, so it's kind of a bit of a circular logic, right? Vote them out, right? But there you go. See, there, right? There's the hook, right?
We should name one of those just for the sake of the reason the LLC loophole is so hard to kill. And what people should know what that is a real estate company can create 300 different corporations for every building they own, and they can max donate 300 times to whatever candidate they want. So they can flood these campaigns with money, and the less people who vote, the cheaper those campaigns are. And the less informed voters there are, the more scared the elected official is that these LLCs, these conglomerates, the real estate lobby in New York City, which is like Texas, like oil in Texas for New York City, in terms of power. I just wanted to name one of the people just because we can, because it's obvious. The reason those loopholes exist is because there's so much money. And it's in their interest to have less people vote.
And just to Jesse's point, I mean, as I recall, and correct me again, tell me if I'm wrong, each LLC in a statewide election can drop in $123,000 or somewhere thereabouts, as I recall.
That's the
max. And so, I mean, we're talking about, you know, significant sums, to control outcomes. And I think that's, again, these are the questions that we need to be asking ourselves as a society and, you know, certainly asking our local community and then, you know, outwardly from that. Is this the world that we want to live in, right? A world where our choices are circumscribed and where, the elections are in some ways predetermined before we even get started? Or do we want to make sure that we have the best possible people that are in place to represent us and to ensure that we get the best possible outcomes for our community?
We're down to our last couple of minutes. Feedback continues to flood in, so our apologies to anyone who we can't get to via email or phone. Dorothy, we'll go to you on the phone next. Please keep it tight because we just have a few moments left. Go ahead, Dorothy.
Yes, good afternoon. I just have a quick question about our rights to independence. So it would seem that independents are almost penalized because you can vote in the Democratic primary or the Republican primary. So what's the difficulty in letting independents vote during those type of primaries and rather than just the general election. I'll take my answer off there.
Okay. Thanks, Dorothy. I'll turn that over to our guest. Michelle, you want to start us off here?
I'm not sure, but I think that's a question for the state political parties. They're the ones who decide how that works and who is allowed to vote in their own primary elections. Is that right?
Does anyone think that should change?
I'd point out that I think the Reform Party just opened it up so that unaffiliated voters can vote in their primaries. I mean, we would be concerned. I think we'd be. We don't have a policy on it, but I would personally be concerned because one major party seems to never have primaries, and another one seems to always have primaries, and so I wouldn't want a bunch of voters from the Republican side voting in our working families primaries, for example, because we're. You know, we could be flooded with people who don't agree with our agenda in our primaries. So,
yeah, I mean, some of the shenanigans are entirely possible. You know, there was an earlier point that was made. You know, it was kind of the argument struck me as a bit of a red herring. But for this one, I mean, there actually is history of folks kind of, you know, voting across party lines, like influence outcomes and that kind of thing. One thing I will say, slightly related, is the notion that we've got, and if this is going to forgive me, but I just need to add my voice to it, that we have all these primaries on different dates, and Tom and I have talked about this on offline before, is really just inane. I mean, it's again, you know, it begs the question. I mean, we've seen it in different places. You know, folks that make a run for federal office promise that they are not going to run for state office, and then turn around and run for state office. We've seen it, right? We know that that happens. So we know in that case who's benefiting, right? And so I just, you know. At some point, we've got to really kind of like reconsolidate these primary dates so that there really is, you know, kind of like one day.
A unified primary date. Yeah, we support that so wholeheartedly. The commissioners in across the board do.
Michelle, I see you nodding as well. Are you hearing these comments from people when you're doing your work on primary days?
Yeah, I find that, you know, I get, because I've been an inspector for a long time, sometimes people reach out to me to ask questions, and they sometimes say, wait, there's a primary coming up? What's happening? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more often we ask people to come to the polls, I think the fewer times they come out.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, I want to thank you for all your questions and comments. We couldn't get to about half of them, so that just means we have to have another conversation about voting access on this program. Also, a number of questions about civic education, so something we'll talk about too. If you are a teacher teaching that, please email us connections@wxxi.org, and we want to sit down with you. We want to hear what you have to say. My thanks to our guest this hour, Tom Ferrazzi from the Monroe County Board of Elections, Simeon Bannister from the Community Foundation, Michelle Long, an election inspector, and Jesse Lenny from the Working Families Party. My thanks to all of you for being here. Thanks for sharing your ideas, your comments. Listeners, thank you as well. Rob Braden's our engineer, Tiana Mignon helping us out on phones. I'm Megan Mack. We'll talk to you on Tuesday.